Did you know that the first bagel was made in the 17th century Poland as a traditional gift for pregnant Jewish women, or that pastrami comes from an Ottoman method of curing meat, that herring brought down the Dutch Empire, or that latkes, the traditional Hanukkah potato pancakes, come from an Italian dish? These are just some of the surprising facts that Gil Marx includes in his Encyclopedia of Jewish Food, published by Wiley. I'm very happy that these and other mouth-watering histories bring Gil Marx to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Really good to be here.
Now, I've always heard that bagels were created as a way of invoking the stirrups of a Polish nobleman, but you say they were given as gifts to pregnant women?
Right. Well, many of the things we think about food are Bubba Mises, which is Yiddish for old wives' tales. They're just wrong. And that has to do with the Siege of Vienna, which actually happened about 70 years after the first mention of bagels in a Jewish source. So, bagels predate that whole episode.
But they become synonymous with New York Jewish food. There was a time when you couldn't find a bagel in any other part of the country until, I guess, lenders started freezing
them.
Well,
you could find them, but what happened was most breads in Europe are made by men in bakeries that were gilt. Bagels were women's food, and it's only a Polish Jewish bread. It's not in other Jewish communities. And the women would make it at home, which is boiled first and then baked. That's the uniqueness of the bagel. And then the husbands and kids would try to sell them. And sometimes the police would try to tax them. And if they didn't pay it, they would confiscate and eat the bagels. And that was part of the cat and mouse game that they played. And so at first you had, like where I grew up, there was a little old lady, Mrs. Cantor, who in her back of her house boiled and baked bagels. And my job and my brother's job, we go over every Sunday morning and pick up a dozen bagels for the family.
Where was this?
Richmond, Virginia, and Charleston, West Virginia. I'm a Southerner. And then what we had happening is that in New York, they became unionized. And you'd have groups of four men in a basement. And it was totally controlled by the union. In order to get part of it, you'd probably have to be related to somebody. And then a guy by the name of Mickey Thompson, who was Jewish and whose other claim to fame was he invented the collapsible ping pong table, he invented this bagel machine. And all of a sudden, anybody can make a bagel. Now, there was so what you had was in 1954, there was a Broadway play called Bagels and Yachts, written by Sholem Shukanda, who did Dona, 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 and many of the other songs. And at intermission, they had to give out bagels because most of the audience didn't know what a bagel was. And the New York Times described it as a donut with rigor mortis. But all of a sudden, with the bagel machine, anybody can make a bagel.
But they're not as good as the old bagels.
No.
In fact, the only bagels I've eaten in recent times that remind me of the original bagels are the ones I found in Montreal.
Montreal, which are a little bit different because there's honey involved in the bagel.
They're a little sweeter, but still,
sweeter.
They're small and they have that nice crunch on the outside.
Well, that's because most of them, unfortunately, with the bagel machine, people stopped boiling them, sort of like steaming a little bit. And then some of them are just a sweet roll with a hole in the middle.
But why Montreal?
Awful. They developed their own culture of bagels. There was the New York culture and the Montreal culture. And unfortunately, the ease and inexpensiveness of a machine bagel won out. And people forget sometimes, people forget schmaltz, which was the flavor and smell of Eastern European Jewish cooking for hundreds and hundreds of years.
That's chicken fat.
It's rendered chicken fat. And now it's considered unhealthy. And there was once a time you'd go into a Jewish deli and there'd be a pitcher of schmaltz, this rendered chicken fat, on the table that you would smear on bread, like a butter or something, and these things change.
How did bagels come to be paired with cream cheese and lox?
Well, that happened during the 20s and 30s. The predominant sophisticated Sunday brunch fare was the Eggs Benedict. Then all of a sudden, but Jews, even Jews who didn't keep kosher would have troubles with Eggs Benedict because it's Canadian bacon. So what, instead of the English muffin, they put a bagel. Instead of the bacon, they put lox. And instead of cream, the hollandaise sauce, there's cream cheese. And cream cheese and lox never touched a bagel anywhere in in Europe. But all of a sudden in the 20s and 30s, it became the standard Jewish brunch fare. And then as the bagel spread across America, so did the whole concept of cream cheese and bagels.
And how did smoked or cured fish come to be associated with Jewish food? It's really a Northern European thing. Gravlax. Lox come from the word gravlax?
Well, gravlax is related. Lox is simply the German word for salmon. Mm-hmm. And gravlax was the sweetest form of cured salmon. And what happened was most of food technology before the 20th century had to do with preserving seasonal food and limited resources. So you had salting and fermentation and processes. So you had in the Mediterranean, you'd have the bacala, which is the salted cod. Now, in the north, they didn't have cod, but what they did have in abundance was herring. And at first they did, but what happened was the Dutch invented a process because the Dutch found herring out in the Atlantic. And that's one of the things you mentioned, why the fall of the Dutch and the rise of the English.
Well, there was a war.
Over the herring and cod wars, which involved – and they would – in order – it would spoil quickly because it's a fatty fish in particular. So they would cut it open, salt it, and put it in barrels. And so salted herring became a way of life throughout Northern Europe, where herring was one if not the predominant form of protein.
My guest is Gil Marks, chef, a rabbi, writer, historian, expert on Jewish cooking, the author of 5 cookbooks, including the James Beard winner and IACP finalist Olive Trees and Honey. His latest is the Encyclopedia of Jewish Food, which is 650 pages or so of interesting information and recipes. It's published by Wiley. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You have undertaken this mammoth task of compiling an encyclopedia of Jewish food, but it represents foods from all over the world, doesn't it? There is no one kind of Jewish food.
There is no. Most Americans kind of think of Jewish food as the Eastern European stuff.
The Ashkenazic.
But there's actually a mosaic of Jewish communities from around the world, many dating back 2,500 years. And each developed their own culture and their own form of food. And I tried to portray this mosaic of foods within the encyclopedia. There's 3 separate Indian Jewish communities, each growing differently with different foods and histories.
Are the kosher laws what unite Jewish foods around the world?
That's one thing. But you have other things. You have Sabbath ideas and holiday things. So that you'll find in many Jewish foods certain biblical fruits and vegetables will be predominant, and honey and things. Other things that on the Sabbath, Jews weren't allowed to cook, and before refrigeration, you would make a salad on Friday, and in order to keep it, you would put vinegar in, and often to counteract the vinegar a little bit, you'd put some honey or sugar in. And so these sweet and sour flavors are very pronounced. And anything from caponata, the eggplant dish, it spread from the Jews from Italy into from Sicily into Italy. And to many of these sweet and sour salads and things. So there's all kind of different things. But basically what more Jews today eat sushi and salsa than they do schmaltz, but those aren't Jewish foods. It's because Jews eat them.
But they are kosher.
They are kosher, yeah. But it's more than that. It's sort of almost like food that's been sanctified by its use within the Jewish community and ideas and identity and culture. To quote Fiddler on the Roof, it's tradition.
Well, in the introduction, you write that the central feature of Jewish food is adaptation. But do kosher laws change in different Jewish areas?
Not greatly. What's adapted is you have local geography and history and food ideas. In Poland, they were, let's put this a little bit crazy in some ways. They didn't like legumes. They thought vegetables were unhealthy. And if they did eat a vegetable like a carrot or something, they would cook it to death. whereas the Sephardic Jews and the Mediterranean Jews love vegetables. I mean, one of the signature aspects of Sephardic food is the richness of the vegetables and the fresh herbs and spices within it. And so each of these are Jewish in their own way.
So let's talk about Hanukkah. Tonight is the beginning of Hanukkah. One of the traditional Ashkenazi dishes is potato pancakes, latkes. Was latkes always a Hanukkah tradition for European Jews?
Well, actually, it's the basic thing about Hanukkah until the 20th century America was a very minor Jewish holiday. You lit some candles, went on with your life. There actually is no mention of any traditional Hanukkah food until the 14th century, when two different traditional foods emerge. One of them is fried foods, which has to do with the whole story of when the Maccabees in 165 BCE reconquered the temple 3 years after the Syrian Greeks had defiled it, could only find one small vial of olive oil that lasted for 8 days.
In the lamps.
In the candelabra of the temple, which actually I kind of figured out that it would actually take like 3 cups of olive oil to light the lamp for 8 days. So it was a small vial that somehow that's a story. Actually, first appears in the Talmud. The original books of the Maccabees don't mention that. But what happens is after the Hashmonaim, the Maccabees seized power after this and became very corrupt, despotic group of people, and their machinations led to the Romans coming in 63 BCE, which is why the Jews ended up in diaspora, because of the Romans. And so the rabbis and the Jews really didn't like the Hashmonaim, so they downplayed their role and the whole military angle and instead concentrated on the spiritual, the olive one, and that became a traditional food. And also in the 14th century—
Wait, in just one tradition, or is that something that we find all throughout various Jewish communities?
It spread throughout the Jewish communities. It starts in – there was interconnections between the Sephardim and Ashkenazim, and you'll see foods usually traveling from the Sephardim into Ashkenazim. Anything like cholent, the Sabbath stew, comes from the Sephardic chamin. We can see the movement of it, and we trace it in the different Sabbath stews in the encyclopedia. You have dishes like pashtida, which was a meat pie that comes out of the Sephardic tradition into Ashkenazic and disappeared when kugel came and replaced it, but has reappeared in modern Israel. So there's interesting histories. So you have the fried foods, and you'll have particularly different sweets, like different forms of donuts and fritters. In India, they make a gulab, which is a milk-based product that they fry and then soak in a rose water syrup. It's very interesting. And so that is common. And the other one that arose in 14th century was dairy products, and particular cheese. And that had to do with the misreading of one of the books of the Apocrypha, the non-canonized ancient Hebrew books, which was Judith. Now, Judith doesn't – there's 4 extant versions of Judith, none of them in the original Hebrew, because since it wasn't part of the Bible, it wasn't canonized, so it was forgotten by Jews, but except in rumors. It's not mentioned in the Talmud or early Jewish things, but it pops up, and – if I have time, one of the story of Judas is basically it's a Babylonian era story that gets changed to the Greek period when they don't have the text. And Judas is this comely young lady, and she's in this town that's besieged by the Babylonians. And she comes up with this plan, basically based upon the biblical story of Deborah. In Deborah, of Sisera, the general, fleeing, and Yael serving him dairy products to make him thirsty, and killing him, and then killing him when he falls asleep. So in this one, she goes with a basket to the camp, feeds him salty cheese, and as he gets thirsty, she gives him wine to slack his thirst. And then when he gets drowsy, she cuts off his head, And the enemy, seeing their general dead, flees, and the city's saved. So because of this dairy cheese connection, it becomes. And the first mention of what we would call a latke, the pancake, is in Italy, is ricotta cheese pancake fried in olive oil. And so the original latke, which actually means little oily, it comes from the Italian Latin word for olive oil.
Well, the Italian Renaissance painters loved to paint pictures of Judith with Holofernes' head. But there were no potatoes in Italy at that time.
No potatoes in Europe at that time.
Because they came over with the Columbian Exchange. We have to take a little break. When we come back, we'll find out what happened then. And also, we invite your calls to 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And by the way, we have a recipe for cheese latkes on our show page. Stay with us for more. And we're back with Gil Marks, whose Encyclopedia of Jewish Food is published by Wiley. It's a huge book, and not just a book that is about food, but also includes things like discussions of the Borscht Belt.
It's culture. Well, food carries culture, and food carries history. And so they're intertwined, particularly in Jewish history, and therefore they're all parts of the book. It's like the Borscht Belt. It was one of the means by which Jewish food entered the American mainstream. I don't know if you remember.
Why is borscht, which is a Russian soup, so synonymous with Jewish food and culture?
Well, Jewish borscht is a little bit different sometimes than Russian borscht. Borscht, actually, the name comes from a form of parsnip from the there.
And it's not beets?
No, beets came later. The borscht actually predates beets. And what they would do is sort of like many early stews, that you would put meat and anything else, vegetables, anything you had in there. And it wasn't a particularly tasty it's called the horse parsnip sometimes. It wasn't a particularly tasty item. And then beets come from either from Italy relatively late in history in the 15th century, the modern beetroot. Before, beets existed, but they only ate the greens beforehand. Only in the 15th century does the modern root begin developing, and it wasn't particularly accepted, except it grew very well in Northern Europe, and they began adding it to their soup, and it soon replaced the older vegetables. But see, one of the prominent ways that in Slavic countries they ate borscht, the meat borscht, was with sour cream. Jews, in the dietary laws, can't mix the dairy with the meat. So what they ended up doing was making what's called kaltborscht, which is a vegetarian borscht, which is more common in America. But that's the Jewish style of borscht, developed, again, that adaptation that you mentioned. And Jews were their role in history, in culinary history, is not so much innovation, but adaptation and transmission. They'll take it from one area. So Jews popularized borscht in America, so it has the Jewish connotation. Kasha. In Americans, most Americans think of kasha as buckwheat. In Slavic languages, it actually means any kind of cooked cereal. But Jews didn't eat that many grains. They primarily ate kasha. And so since Jews popularized buckwheat in America, buckwheat growth in America, it took on the Jewish connotation rather than the wider Slavic connotation. And that repeats itself over and over again.
And it also provided America with an awful lot of vegetarian dishes, that didn't include any meat because of that certain meals had to not have any meat in them. A reminder that our number here is 646-829-3985. If you want to join in this conversation or ask Gil Marks any questions about various Jewish foods or how to cook something in particular, we were talking earlier about how the latke came from a cheese pancake or whatever in Italy. How did it wind up becoming a Jewish dish? And how did it wind up becoming a Jewish dish that we often pair with sour cream and applesauce?
Okay, well, that's all this movement through history that we see. So the Jews of what often happened is that a dish would come from the during the medieval period, a dish would come from the Muslim world into Italy, and things like dumplings show up in the 1100s, late 1100s. Then pasta comes in the 1200s, before Marco Polo. We have several mentions of, but no matter what the Italians tell you, it really didn't exist before that. But it moves, and then you'll see about 50 years or so after these dishes show up in non-Jewish Italian sources, they show up in Jewish Italian-Jewish sources. And about 100 years after that, they show up in German Jewish sources. And so there's this movement. So the pancake, the cheese pancake spreads from the Italian Jewish community, where they fried it with olive oil, up into the Ukraine and into Poland. It comes by way of the Ukrainians into Ashkenazi cooking. But when you get up there, they don't have a lot of oil. Oil's very expensive, and also as you get farther north, the soft cheeses used to make the pancakes become rarer at that time of year. So only people in the right places with the right money can make a cheese pancake. And since if you can't fry it in oil, what was the predominant frying medium of Eastern European Jews was schmaltz, the rendered chicken fat. Again, you can't mix the meat and the milk, so they began substituting originally buckwheat. The ground buckwheat, sort of a bellini, that they could fry in the schmaltz. And buckwheat also comes relatively late in the 15th century. It shows up because the Mongols and Tartars bring it from Siberia. It's a relative of rhubarb that shows up and then spreads from the 1400s into Europe. And that was the problem. So you either had cheese or buckwheat, and then the potato comes from South America. Columbus brought back the sweet potato. Columbus never saw a white potato.
Potatoes are from the Andes.
From the Andes. But sweet potatoes spread because everybody loved them. White potatoes were, and when they show up in Europe, they're thought of being poisonous at best. And it took an act of British Parliament to allow potatoes to be used as animal feed. And so they were ignored, basically, until what happened was a Frenchman by the name of Auguste Parmentier was kept during the Seven-Year War between France and Germany, was a captive. And the Germans fed their animals and their prisoners of war potatoes. And Parmentier realized after living off of potatoes for 6 or 7 years that not only wasn't it harmful, but it was actually beneficial because he did very well off of it. And he introduced it into France, where in the wake of the French Revolution, there was very severe famine, and potatoes were necessary to feed the people in France, and all of a sudden potatoes caught on. And so you're talking that the first real use outside of Ireland, which was exceptional because, again, the British kicked the Irish off of their land, and they lived in areas, the Irish people, and where nothing would grow but a potato almost. And so in that area, but primarily in France, and then it spreads after the French Revolution, and then it spreads to Germany, where the upper class and the upper middle class would not touch a potato because that was poor man's food. But amongst the population, it became very popular, and they create in Germany the first potato pancakes. And then what happened finally, they couldn't force an Eastern European to eat a potato. The kings tried to force them. They wouldn't eat potatoes. But there were 2 years of famine in the 1840s in Poland and Ukraine, in which potatoes were the only thing that would grow. And all of a sudden, the Jews not only started eating potatoes, they lived off of it. And what happens after that is in 1880, with his assassination of Tsar Alexander, you have the official pogroms of the Russian government, and you have the first mass movement of Eastern European Jews out of there into both the first movement of Jews to Israel and into America in the 1880s. And millions of Jews leave, but the population continues to explode more than ever in their history because of the potato feeding them. And so so to answer your question finally, after all of that, I am a rabbi after all, I have to pontificate. The iconic potato latke shows up in the 1850s as this part of the pantheon of Jewish foods.
And you can have it in this country with applesauce. You wouldn't have it anywhere else, but you could have that with meat. If you're having a dairy meal, you can put sour cream on it if you wish. There are some pretty surprising entries here. For example, the banana. Not many people would associate bananas with Jewish food.
Well, again, one of the things I did is sometimes foods are so interconnected by the Jews' role of transmission, that it was a guy by the name of Sam the Banana Man who took, before him, potatoes were bananas were this obscure food generally relegated to certain port areas. And he came over in steerage from Russia as a teenager and earned a livelihood in bananas in what was known as seconds, in that any ripe bananas were not taken because they couldn't survive any journey anywhere. So you had to only green time. So he would buy up these cheap called second bananas and sell them and made a profit until he became a fortune. And he also created the whole thing of Chiquita bananas, in where he actually put a brand name on produce, which was unheard of before. And so he transformed this relatively little thought of thing into one of the predominant. He also created the whole thing of the Banana Republic. He was the one who did that, who overthrew the Costa Rican government in order to put in one more to his liking. And another interesting fact is
not the most admirable person.
Not the
most
admirable, but he also became a Zionist, and he bought a boat that he gave to the Haganah that was renamed the Exodus. And which is why it was under Costa Rican registry, because he had all that power there. So there's all these interconnections of history that in play. And it's similar with yogurt. Now, yogurt predates the Jews, let alone anything else. But if you ask the average American in 1960s what yogurt was, 95% would tell you, I have no idea. Within 10 years, 95% of Americans were eating yogurt on a regular basis. And that all had to do with a Sephardic Jewish doctor by the name of Isaac Caruso, who left Salonika, Greece, which at the time was Ottoman Empire, moved to Spain. And so many of his patients had stomach problems, he prescribed yogurt, and it was hard to get there. So he went and started selling commercially yogurt, and he named his company after the nickname of his son. His son's name was Daniel Caruso. The company was Danone. Hence Dannon. Daniel Caruso just died last year at the age of 103, so the yogurt must have worked for him. And Daniel took over the company in France. During World War II, he, escaping the Nazis, came to America, created Dannon here. He was the first one to sell in the small disposable cups and also the first ones to flavor it, starting with strawberries and other flavors. So if you think of the incredible marketing thing that transformed a totally obscure item within a decade into ubiquitous, and that was Daniel. So, again, it's not so much that the Jews innovated, but they transform and transmit constantly.
Or they just adapt, like hummus, which is so popular in Israel, but it wasn't invented as a Jewish food.
No, hummus, falafel, pita are not – were not innately Jewish food. Probably the Copts, the Christians of Egypt, created falafel. But the Jews, again, they adopted and they spread it, and they also changed. So the first mention of putting the falafel into the pita bread as a sandwich was in Israel by Jews. Yemenite Jews in Israel seem to have done that. So again, they transform it, and they also are the ones who popularize it. You find it in America and the West.
Now, Gil, we have just moments left, but this is a huge book, and it has a lot of entries.
655.
Did you do all the research?
I did. Everything is mine. Many of these books have staffs of 100. I did it all by myself, but to me, that's what's fun. I love putting these history puzzles together. I love finding new facts. And as I said, much of what we think about food is Bubba Mice's, old wives' tales.
So part of the fun was finding out the real story.
Part of the fun is it's hard sometimes looking for that needle in the haystack, but that's what I love to do.
And we just dealt with a few of the many items dealt with in this book. If you want to know about corned beef or horosis.
Or afikoman or matzah or many things.
All mentioned and, in fact, dealt with in all their variations in Gil Mark's Encyclopedia of Jewish Food.
And there's also 300 recipes, so it's actually a cookbook, too.
And it is published by Wiley. And I want to thank you so much for being with us to talk about it. And have a happy holiday. And should I be cooking from this tonight?
Sure. You can do a cheese latke tonight, and you'll love it.
And by the way, that we do have a recipe for cheese latkes on our show page at wnyc.org. Thank you again, Gil Marks.
Thank you very much. Love being here.